Once again, I just want to use this opportunity very quickly to thank the Ronning Center for partnering with the Thomas Merton Society of Canada. Really, it's the other way around because they did all the work. We just brought some plenary speakers with us. And it's been a wonderful Friday night and Saturday, and I'm very grateful to David Goa and to Robin and Dietmar, too. I suppose there might be other people whom I don't know about, but I'd like to say on behalf of the Thomas Merton Society of Canada, thank you very much. And now I'd like to introduce to you Ron Dart. Ron teaches in the Department of Political Science, Philosophy, and Religious Studies at the University College of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford. Ron is also on the board of directors of the Thomas Merton Society of Canada, and I always think of Ron as the Renaissance man. He, too, has delivered talks about Merton and written in academic journals far and wide. And the reason I say Ron is the Renaissance man is that he always integrates Merton with someone else. And today he's going to be talking about Grant. Also, when I think of Ron, I think of Merton and the Beats, and he's written a book about Thomas Merton and the Beats, and Ron also is intimately familiar with the Cascades and the home of the Beats because he lives nearby and he climbs those mountains every summer. And I think that keeps them fresh. Anyway, please welcome Ron Dart.
This being a conference on the roots of war, before I step into the presentation, this sort of question runs right through the soul and fabric of our family. My son has just returned home from 7 months in Afghanistan. The stories he can tell are quite horrendous from what he's seen. There's times he would phone us being ambushed by the Taliban and say so-and-so's had their legs blown off, then the phone would die on us, and we thought that was the end of him. And he's been asked to join the elite forces in Canada, the Joint Task Force, which is similar to the SAS or Delta Force or Navy SEALs. So we have him on one hand, but he's a very, very thoughtful person, often wondering why they're in Afghanistan, the pointlessness of being there, and the insanity of it in many ways. So he's torn between being a very highly skilled, in one sense, assassin, and yet the political chess game that goes on that he's a part of. And he's going to have to make some difficult decisions in the next few years as he moves in. My daughter, on the other hand, is very, very much the dove. So she's 22 and he's 25, and we thought it was going to be quite amusing a few years ago when they had the G7 nations in Kananaskis. My son was the one who had to help clear much of the Kananaskis area so they wouldn't have protesters. And our daughter threatened to bring in protesters through the forests. And they both know the outdoors very, very well, being trained, almost breastfed, and climbing in the outdoors so she could slip through trees like the wind. And he's equally great abilities in the outdoors and the rocks. And we thought, this is going to be interesting. Our son is going to have to arrest his sister and all the things that go along with that. So I can assure you, and my wife is just this wonderful, she looks like Galadriel out of Lord of the Rings, and she plays the harp, and she's just produced a CD, a Taze CD. So we have some very, very interesting discussions at home, and learning to love the other, that which you are not, and crossing the bridge and hear them. And with our son back from Afghanistan, we've had to listen to the same stories told many, many times about some of the great tragedies he's seen and for him to reflect upon it. So issues of war and peace, they're not only sort of important academic, intellectual, practical issues that are out there, they're also run right through the fabric and flesh of our very soul and family structure. So the discussions that go on in our home traverse quite a terrain much of the time. So this is a conference on Thomas Merton, so most of you have heard of Thomas Merton now. For those of you who hadn't heard of him before, he was born in 1915, died in 1968. How many of you have heard of George Grant? Good, that some people haven't heard. He's probably one of our greatest Canadian philosophers and public intellectuals of the 20th century. He was born in 1918, and he died in 1988. I've decided to compare these two because even though they're both very important and pivotal 20th century thinkers, I think probably two of the mountain peaks of 20th century thought in terms of the issues they dealt with, and they crossed the ridges of these issues in a very nimble, almost mountain goat-like manner. They bring back to us an older story of what it means to be human and how to live the meaningful or good life in our journey through time. The second reason I've called this, one of the reasons I've called this Radical Conservatives, this conference is being held in Alberta, which is seen as the seat of historic conservatism. It's the world of Eberhardt, the Manning dynasty, Stockwell Day, and Stephen Harper. So our understanding of conservatism has been shaped largely in Canada by a certain Albertan ethos. Now, the question that we have to ask, is this understanding of conservatism classical high Tory Canadian conservatism? Or is it more a reflection of American republicanism? And is the Conservative Party in Canada, should it be more aptly named the Republican Party of Canada? When most of us think conservative, we think lighter state, lighter taxes, more power to the individual, more regional power, more local power, and in Canada, usually pro-American foreign policy. That essentially is what Stephen Harper is doing with George Bush right now. He essentially is a lapdog for American foreign policy in many ways. Has that been, though, the historic high Tory or red Tory tradition in Canada? By looking at George Grant and back of him, Stephen Leacock, who some of you may know, most Canadians know him as our great humorist. In fact, he was one of the most important political theorists in Canada. He held the chair of political science at McGill for 30 years, and his best published books are in political theory, not in humor. Their understanding of conservatism was very, very different. They believed in a strong state, higher taxes, so the common weal could be provided for in this nation, in the true north. So things like health care, education, public culture, CBC, environmental issues were protected, and a whole range of other services. Two notions of conservatism. I want to briefly touch on that, simply for the reason both federally and here in this province, we have a certain understanding. In our language, talking about Orwell, our language has been co-opted. People who have no history believe anything they're told. And history is a form of intellectual self-defense. It allows you to talk back and say you are using language in an inappropriate way to hoodwink a population into believing things they should not believe. Hence, I've used Grant and Thomas Merton, because Merton is, in many ways, deeply conservative. And I want to look at some of the nature of what that conservatism actually is and why it is radical conservatism that is cutting to the roots of our very being and the political systems and the world in which we live. I'll look at that in three ways, and I'm sure many of your minds are turning to mud at this time, having to sit through so many presentations, so I won't labor a lot of these points or go into the depth. I'll be more like a stone skimming the surface of the water, and we can maybe dive for the pearls in the discussion or at another time. But the three things I want to look at is the issue of contemplation and action, the vita contemplativa and the vita activa, and how those have been reversed, and how Merton and Grant called people back to the primacy of the contemplative over against the active. Second, their understanding of the church in which they were loyal to, yet critical of. I'll point out how some can be committed but not critical. Some can be critical but not committed. The task is how you remain committed but critical. It's the mark of a prophet, usually. And then third, I want to look at their understanding of politics, questions of justice and peace and war. And so it's a highly integrated vision they're working out of. The depth and transformative power of the inner life, how it works out in community and imperfectly through institutions, and then how we engage the world in which we live on the big issues. So let me start with number one, the contemplative and the active. Hannah Arendt, in her great book, The Human Condition, argued a great reversal had come to be in time, and it came to be with the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. And she argued with the coming to be of the 16th century, there was a reversal took place throughout the classical tradition of Plato and Aristotle, Cicero, Seneca, Augustine, the great medieval mystical theologians. The contemplative was primary. The journey to the inner life, the spiritual disciplines of that inner life, the spiritual directors which guided one through that inner life, that was the primary place to be. And through that journey itself, one came to know the difference between the ego and its inflated wants, its illusions, its fantasies, its drivenness, and the deeper self, which can never be denied, eradicated. In the Orthodox tradition, it's called God's image. In the Greek classical tradition, it's the phusis, the very nature that is built genetically into our very being. And that cannot be eradicated or destroyed. Hence, the human journey, the contemplative journey, on pilgrimage, Chaucer-like with others, is to hike that path to that inner still center that T.S. Eliot talks about in the Four Quartets. For it is there that is the diamond of the new self, the image of God, our true phusis or nature. That's a lifelong journey. It's not done automatically. It's done through many a dark night of the soul, an ability to go to those places we often don't want to go to. St. Teresa of Avila, great 16th century mystic, compared the soul to a castle. She talked about the tendencies to go to certain of those rooms that are well decorated, well constructed, but we often have a lock on those rooms we don't want to visit. And it's only going to those places and allowing the shutters to blow open and the wind of the spirit to blow through and the canopy over our heads to see it and day star to shine in that in fact our new being, what Paul Tillich would call our new being, is realized. It's very interesting. In the classical tradition, it was primarily what we would call a creedal tradition. Increasingly by the Protestant tradition, it became confessional, and people fought about crossing their T's and dotting their I's. And action became predominant. And this is where you get what we call the Protestant work ethic. To the point today where people can hardly sit still for 2 minutes. And this is what, of course, the great Eastern traditions have brought to the West. When the West lost and forgot its contemplative heritage, many in the West, like Merton, then turned to the East for insight, and rightly so. Because we had lost the paths, the tracks of our old tradition to the shrine at the middle of the soul. And other traditions came to remind us. Most of us in our own experience, I'll be teaching a third-year course in the Buddhist tradition this fall. And of course, the danger of the academic tradition is you teach it as an object. You could be studying butterflies, elephants, or horses. Now we study Buddhism as a thing, an object you put over there and you look at it as an object. And that, of course, is one way of studying. The other, of course, is the way of love, in which my soul is put on the anvil and transformed. And hence the whole language of attentiveness, or being there, or being truly alert to who we are internally and the other who is before us. This is the contemplative way. And so the whole contemplative traditions within Christianity were about cultivating that garden of the inner life to find the deeper self, from which then people would live out of authentically, and knowing all the mirages and the counterfeits and the distortions that can creep in that process. I do a lot of climbing throughout the year. I've just got back. I was climbing in Whistler for a few days. Actually, I was out on 3 large climbs this week, so my legs are actually getting rather restless. I've been sitting all day. I'm used to climbing up rock faces and living in alpine huts on tops of peaks. But it's often interesting. I'll take some people up who'll climb, do very long climbs, and we'll get to an alpine hut. We just get there. And the next thing, some of the younger bucks say, "Well, now what are we going to do?" Well, we're not going to do anything. And the danger of sort of rock jocks and peak bagging is just everything's a task, everything's a goal. Once we've accomplished it, we move on. And I'll often say, now we're going to start the real journey. How do we learn the discipline of going to the inner core and center and being still and knowing the counterfeits and distortions which threaten to shipwreck our soul? That's the contemplative question. And at the end of it, or the telos that we move towards, is what's called the unio mystica, in which we are so united with God that in the Greek tradition, in fact, that we are deified and we become godlike. Now, Thomas Merton, as we all know, one of the reasons he left the world, because he knew what it was like to, as it were, live both internally and externally in New York at rush hour. The demands, the hurly-burly of life in the valley, and then how we internalize that and we do not know how to stay still. He went to a monastery which he thought was about contemplation, only to discover often that it was busier than the world that he ran from. So busy making butter and cheese and wine and liturgy that he hardly had time to stop. And he remained a prophet to the Cistercians, calling them back to their origins of Bernard de Clairvaux and Ealhred of Revoux and William of St. Thierry and people like that. And the Catholic Church, of course, had also become co-opted by this frantic Protestant work ethic, an inability to be still, to slow down, to go deeper. George Herbert, a great Anglican priest, he said, take some time to be alone to see what your soul doth wear. And it's in being alone you can see what your soul doth wear at various layers. It's out of that inner core then. And of course, Merton, much of his writings in the 1950s, it was about recovering, reclaiming the great contemplatives, not only in the Cistercian past, but in the Christian tradition itself. We moved into a home a few years ago. It's top of a mountain. People had lived there before. And I got up into the forest and I was bushwhacking a bit, only to discover that I picked up an old trail. And I started clearing the leaves, the blowdowns, and there was a trail that all went all over the ridge of a mountain. What had often happened to the Christian tradition is the trail had become overgrown, and Merton played a very important role in clearing that off again so people could return to the source, the pure gold, the mother lode beneath their feet. And in many ways, much of the 1940s and 50s in his writing was an attempt to get to that deep source. It was about dying as the seed dies, and as the seed dies, you break out of the skin of your ego into what you're meant to be, into a much fuller person. It's like new seeds of contemplation. As the seeds of the divine are constantly being sown in the soil of the soul. If we allow those to break through their skin, the freedom of our new being will emerge, just as a bird can take wings from a cage. For 10 years, I worked with Amnesty International, and one of the symbols was the bird in the cage. And often the ego imprisons us in a cage, and God longs to liberate us, to spread our wings, to fly under the blue sky. And that's what the great liberation of our new being is about, and that's what Merton. Now, George Grant was also doing the same thing. George Grant is probably one of the greatest public philosophers that Canada has produced. He came from a very important family in Canada. His grandfather was George Parkin, who initiated the Rhodes Scholarship of Canada. His other grandfather was George Grant, who was the principal of Queen's University, the famous George Grant. That time he came from a family, one of the most important families in Canada, who were involved at university-level education. His father was the principal of Upper Canada College, one of the most important schools in Toronto, for training a new generation of Canadians to be deeply nationalist and to love their country. Stephen Leacock attended there. George, many of the great Canadians are products of the Upper Canada College tradition, in which its great classical education as it's applied to the life of Canada. Now, Grant was trained. He did a degree in theology at Oxford, and then he started teaching philosophy at Dalhousie. And he came to see a terrible shift had happened in philosophy. One of the things for me, I teach political science, philosophy, and religious studies. And one of the things all those three disciplines share in their origins is the heart of all learning is the contemplative and knowing yourself. And the disciplines that are involved, you study Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, any of these great thinkers who were philosophers and political theorists and religious thinkers, the contemplative was the heartbeat of their very soul. And Grant saw that some terrible things, a tragedy had occurred intellectually with the coming to be of certain elements of the Protestant tradition and then with certain elements of the Enlightenment tradition. This took him back to Plato, to Aristotle, to the patristic tradition of the Latin West and Greek East. And he argued again and again, of course, to who he saw as Martin Heidegger, as the great philosopher who critiqued the modern world. And he saw the purpose of education was not to pass on information, statistics, but was to take students into a deeper level of who they were meant to be and release them to know themselves and to live in a much more meaningful manner. He had great debates. He had a huge debate at York University in which he clashed with the administration. He then became the head at McMaster for 20 years and headed up the religious studies department, in which he argued religious studies is not primarily a subject you study. It's something in which you are studied by God. And you are transformed and you fall in love with the great lover of the universe. And we are wooed and drawn into the overtures of the divine love. And if we always stand distant, always holding the other over as an object, we will never grow into the meaning of love, because your love only takes place in unity and in oneness with the other. I think anyone who knows and has been involved in any relationships, they know the transforming power of unity in which you are. It's like Catherine in Wuthering Heights. I am Heathcliff. Heathcliff is me. And Aristotle said, what are friends? Two bodies, one soul. That's where the contemplative, it unites us, brings us from our separateness of soul into a unity and a mingling in which we are no more alone. Now, Grant and Merton were aware that this was the heartbeat of the contemplative tradition. The means you use are secondary. The end you're moving toward is transformation into unity with God and unity with one another and the very heartbeat of the earth itself. So until that is experientially understood, the life of action, or vita activa, can become very distorted or bizarre, manipulative, driven, and a whole range of other things. Until a person is at one in their deep inner being, their life of action can be quite erratic, and they can even seem to be doing the right things, but for the wrong reasons. As I said, this took both men, Merton and Grant, because the trail had been lost in the West. It had been forgotten. Leaves had grown over. They were decaying over the trail. Brambles had fallen over. It took both men to the East and to the West, of course. But they saw in the East the Zen Buddhism, the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, elements of Sufi tradition, elements where that was still practically preserved as a means of transformation. So throughout the latter half of the 50s and certainly in the 1960s, Thomas Merton became a pioneer and a bell ringer in many ways of a new way of understanding interfaith interaction. It wasn't an academic study of religions, but was an experiential understanding of journeying with the other into a deeper way of a living and understanding life in God. George Grant's grandfather was the first person in Canada in the 19th century that wrote a book on other religions in a sympathetic and empathetic manner. The Grant family has been at the forefront in Canadian life of, in fact, engaging people of other faiths, recognizing there were deep insights. And as I said, he started the religious studies department at McMaster University, where I did my studies. And at that department, it was the biggest graduate department in North America that dealt with interfaith issues. We had some of the very finest practitioners and scholars from all over the world would come regularly to McMaster. So it was a very ripe time in my life and a very exciting time to be able to study in that place with some of the finest women and men who I'll never forget, one of the women, great Sufi scholar, probably one of the finest in the world at the time. She was to give a lecture. It's quite amusing. She starts off her first 10 minutes, she closed her eyes. 20 minutes into the lecture, she was looking over here, and for 40 minutes of the lecture, she talked to the wall, only to realize at the end she'd been talking to a wall. And turned around, and it's all apologetic. But her work in Sufism to this day is considered one of the finest. But we had some of the greatest people there at the time, and it was largely through George Grant's work that he insisted that he wanted the study of religion not to be a study of merely an academic approach, what he called museum culture or objectifying things, but he had to be a profoundly engaged tradition, in which one enters the depths, and all the teachings were just pointers. They were just signposts saying, now take the road to where you're going. You can't keep sitting around talking about it or you'll never go anywhere. So a certain form of intellectual life can paralyze the soul from moving to the depths of the destination itself. And treading water goes on and on. Both men, then the second, if you can see, both men were very, very committed to the life of the church. Merton, in his early years, of course, he comes in very enthusiastic, a keener, uncritical. Seven Story Mountain represents the work of a young novice in many ways. I have various friends of mine who grew up Roman Catholic, and they read that, and they say, well, that wasn't the Catholicism I grew up in. You know, it's a very, very much a romantic view of the Roman Catholic Church, and yet there's deep truth in it. I might also say when Merton turned to the Catholic tradition, it's very interesting, he turned to very important medievalists. Gilson, Maritain, there was a great revival of the medieval contemplative tradition going on that brought Thomas Merton to the Roman Catholic tradition. It didn't take Merton too long as a monk at Gethsemane, grappling with the meaning of the contemplative, facing the demands of what it means to be a monk, and then the bigger Roman Catholic hierarchy in the 50s, to discover these were imperfect people in an imperfect institution, and he could either cut and run, which is always a temptation, or in fact these could be the very means to transform him. And he waffled all over, from either looking for other places, contemplative centers, to questioning whether he should leave, to finally settling in and seeing in fact this was the very family in which God was going to transform Thomas Merton. Now, if he had left, would he have written what he wrote today, or what we know exists today? It was through going through many hard and difficult issues, both with people who marginalized him, through abbots that sometimes didn't understand him, through abbot generals that censored him, that he remained faithful. Now, some people would say, well, you're in an abusive relationship, why would you leave? Was it an abusive relationship, or was it a relationship God had given him to transform him? And did he become aware of that at a certain point in his journey? He began committed, but obviously uncritical. Through his experience, he became critical, but never uncommitted. The final phase of a prophet and a saint is to be deeply critical in terms of cutting to the very core where you're wanting the people to be, but also deeply loyal. That's a very, very hard position to be, because you're often misunderstood, you're marginalized, you're treated indifferently, you're contested. It creates tension. But it's often out of that tension that the dross disappears and the gold emerges. The chaff goes, the wheat emerges. Much more difficult place. George Grant joined the Anglican Church. He came from a very well-heeled Presbyterian tradition. His wife was Roman Catholic, and they joined the Anglican Church of Canada in 1956. He and his wife played a very, very important role in the 1950s and 60s in the Anglican Church, challenging it again and again on a whole range of very, very important issues. He was often very misunderstood in the Anglican Church of Canada. And yet he stayed the course. He was critical of the Anglican Church when he didn't speak up as loud as it could on the Vietnam War. He was critical of the Anglican Church when it didn't go after the American Empire as much as it could have. He was a darling of the left at that point. By the 80s, he raised the question of abortion. Then he was a darling of the right. One of the things in the culture wars today we face is that the left and right are sort of forms of intellectual tribalism. And you don't want to goose-step at any of those tribes. There is great truth in elements of the right, and there is great truth in elements of the left. And Thomas Merton and George Grant, as they grappled with the contemplative active, an understanding of the church, and then it's applied to the world that we live in, and the hot-button ethical, economic, and social questions, they were too bright, too gifted, and too prophetic, in the most serious sense of that word, to be co-opted by the tribalism or clannishness of the right and left. Now, of course, when you are not co-opted, then you're shot at by both sides, aren't you? If you're not an ideologue of the right, you're often welcomed by the left, but you critique elements of the left, they shoot at you. You critique the right but embrace some of its elements, then you're distrusted and you're seen as a traitor on both sides. Prophets are often misunderstood by both sides. They were in good company. What, in fact, Grant and Merton give us is a synthesis of the contemplative and the prophet that are not tribal and offer us a third way of understanding ethics, social questions, and politics that we still need to hear more from in our day. As often political parties merely reflect ideological sloganeering, we need women and men in all of those parties to challenge them to go deeper to a much more profound ethical and philosophical level in grappling with these issues. One of Grant's great heroes was Thomas More, and Thomas More wrote Utopia. And in book one of Utopia, More was Lord Chancellor of England at the time, and Raphael went to the New World. This was the time when people were going to Central America, as it were, and they saw these people seemingly live in a paradisial utopian existence, working 3 or 4 hours a day, sun was always shining. Raphael comes back to England, and he compares what he sees as the corruption in England's fair and pleasant land with this utopian community in Central America. And Moore says to Raphael, after Raphael has told him the story of what he was seeing and what he sees England as, he says, "We've got to reform England and make it a just place, a peaceable place." And Moore says, "Listen, I'm Lord Chancellor under Henry. I share your idealism. But if you want to bring those changes, you have to join the political process. Will you get on the boat with me?" Political parties are the boat. One of the things coming from the West Coast, we travel by ferry from mainland to the Gulf Islands or to the Vancouver Island. How do you move something from idealism, the shoreline of idealism, to the other shoreline of implementing that idealism? Political parties are the boats that move us. They're the big ferries that imperfectly move us across the waters of politics. Now, Raphael had all these reasons for not getting in. It won't be perfect. I'll have to compromise. And he lists a laundry list of reasons not to get involved politically. And Moore says to him, "You know, I share your idealism. But your utopianism, you're allowing the perfect become the enemy of the good. And if you ever want your ideals to be imperfectly realized, come participate with me. And we will never perfectly realize the ideal. We will always imperfectly work on it." And Raphael turns his back and walks away. Of course, Moore stays in the process. Now, when Grant and Merton move into the area of politics, it's one thing to critique in their time, in the 50s and 60s, what was going on in Vietnam, the horrendous things. George Grant was at the very center of that in Canada. In fact, in 1965, he wrote the most important work in Canadian political theory called Lament for a Nation, in which he lamented the way in which Canadians in the 1963 election, Pearson was elected, and he knew Pearson would sell out Canada. Pearson was a great friend of Kennedy. There were two people Kennedy hated with a passion. One was General Sukarno of Indonesia, who was aligned with Nehru. The other was Diefenbaker, because Diefenbaker would not give him his own way in Canada. Diefenbaker, Kennedy said, "You will put warheads on the bulwarks in Canada." Diefenbaker said, "We will not." Diefenbaker said, "We're going to trade with Cuba." Kennedy said, "You are not." Diefenbaker said, "Don't tell us what to do in our country." Diefenbaker said, "We're going to trade with Red China and Mao, and we have a lot of identification with what they're doing there." Kennedy said, "Doing that will block your shipments." Diefenbaker says, "Don't touch us. This is a different nation. We have identification with some of the struggles in China and Cuba." Interesting, Grant, in supporting Diefenbaker, highlighted for us an understanding of conservatism in Canada which is certainly not pro-American. It is critical of both the democratic tradition and its foreign policy as well as the Republican tradition. Thomas Merton, in grappling with the political questions of his time, was as critical often of the Kennedy administration as of the Republican, and he came out of what you would call a radical or anarchist tradition. The Dorothy Day tradition is very important in that. Now, as I said, it's one thing to be concerned with the civil rights issues of the 50s and 60s, the Vietnam War, the nuclear policy that was going on, and the human rights violation in Central America, which Merton was very aware of through Ernesto Cardenal and others. A little story on Ernesto Cardenal. When I was on staff with Amnesty, I was head of their Middle Eastern work for many years. But I often had to go and visit with heads of state, and the Sandinistas were in power in the 1980s, and Ernesto Cardenal was the foreign minister. And the Sandinista governments had committed some human rights violations with the Mosquito Indians, so I spent the afternoon with Ernesto Cardenal going over one of our publications which critiqued the Sandinistas, and we spoke frankly about it. But once we got through that, I said, "And what do you think of Thomas Merton?" "Well, you know, he started talking in his quick Spanish, and he didn't stop for 3 hours." Once we got by the business and explained the Sandinistas' position in regards to the Mosquito Indians. And then he gave me a lovely little copy of his book, Cosmic Canticles, signed it very, very nicely. But Merton was aware of things like the civil rights, the Vietnam, the nuclear issues, American foreign policy in Central America. But the question, as with Moore and Raphael, is how do you deal with it? Beyond protest, beyond "I don't like it," beyond "these are human rights violations." What is the strength of protest? What is its limitations? Is it too small a boat to ferry you across? What is the strength of advocacy politics? And what is its limitations? Now, Grant came out of a tradition in Canada, what we would call high Toryism or red Toryism. Some people think those are contradictions in terms. I did a book on the red Tory tradition about 7 or 8 years ago, which Archbishop Lazar published through Synaxis Press. And another book a couple of years ago called the Canadian high Tory tradition. Grant was very involved in the civil rights issue in the 60s. In fact, he was so close with the student union for the peace action. But as many peaceniks can be, they can be so ideological and critical, if you don't follow them on each point, then you get your ears boxed. You get rejected. And he raised questions about their peace tactics. They wanted to go into the House of Commons and lay down and be dragged out by the police. And he said, "That has its place, but there's also other ways of challenging Canadian policy in some of these issues." And they turned on him with a vengeance. He smiled and said, Is that how peaceful you are? You're going to bring peace in the world that way. You can't even get along with someone who's different with you, in which you share. You differ on means, you share the end. But Grant's argument, and he would be out on the forefront when Litton Industries in Rexdale was putting together the guidance systems for cruise missiles. It was Grant who was out there as a conservative, protesting not only the making of those things in Canada, but how they were going to be used in other parts of the world. This is a conservative. And many other conservatives were with him on that. But Grant also believed that you had to work through political parties again and again to bring those changes. I'm always amused by people who come up to you when our son's in Afghanistan and says, "Say, we're praying for you." And I say, "In what political party did you vote for?" It's no good to pray for someone if you drive a car 80 miles an hour into a brick wall and you say you're praying for someone. And if you vote for a political party that drives the kids to war, your prayers are rendered ineffective by your actions. Political parties are those great fairies that imperfectly have created in Canada a healthcare system which is universal, an educational system which is affordable, employment insurance, a national CBC, environmental concerns, many, many other areas. Does that mean they're perfect? Of course not. Does that mean there's not politicking? Of course not. But Plato realized to have the courage, which is one of the great four classical virtues, to enter into imperfection, and as Moro once was, to be a catalyst and salt and light for change, that is a very, very noble calling. Does it mean it'll be easy? Of course not. Does it mean there'll be backstabbing? Of course there will be. A few years ago, I was very involved with David Orchard when he was quite involved with the Progressive Conservative Party to try and bring it back to its classical heritage. He used to spend time with us, spent many a night at our place chatting. One of the deals he cut with Peter MacKay is that he brought Peter MacKay in to become the head of the new Progressive Conservative Party when Joe Clark stepped down, that he would not merge with the Republican Party or the Reform Alliance. Peter MacKay literally within a few weeks joined forces with Stephen Harper and created the Conservative Party. Did David Orchard quit because he had a knife stuck in his back? He continues on. Courage. Even when you're betrayed, when knives are stuck in your back, it's a lot of courage. Often we can get sentimentalism creeps into politics, that if I don't get my way or it doesn't work out the way I want, I'll do protest, advocacy, or just become cynical. Well, the real world of politics is a world of challenge, of backstabbing, of struggle, and yet being faithful through that is not an easy protest, an easy process, but courage is one of the great of the four cardinal virtues that allow people to stand. I've been on committees of various political parties over the years, still involved. But they are the means by which, when we look at things of injustice, Canada's involvement in Afghanistan, are we going to go into Iraq, what's happening to our educational system in Canada, our healthcare system, not to be involved in the political parties or the fairies that keep those things going is to contribute to the destruction of those very social systems we need that have made us unique. And it's not enough to say what makes Canada Canadians or we're not Americans. That's a negative definition. There are many positive things that make Canada what it is the true North. And we may have to do a great deal of fighting through political parties to keep that, but not to engage in the processes to contribute to the problems. And then when the ship capsizes or goes down, we weren't a part of the process and we contribute, not helping steer that ship to the other shoreline across the water. Thomas Merton, George Grant, that in politics, there's the one thing, the issues you have to deal with. That's the revel of the peak, thinking through the big issues, the questions of justice and peace. The second issue is, how do you deal with the issues, which is a question of means. Is it protest? Is it advocacy? Is it political parties? I think this is where George Grant can come and offer us a gentle criticism of perhaps Merton's understanding of politics. So in conclusion, what do Merton and Grant offer us? One, they offer us a way of reversing the contemplative active and calling us back to a deeper understanding of the self. Two, they offer us a way of being committed yet critical to the very community, which is an important boat. And three, they offer us a way of being public in a way that is not ideological, on the one hand, that transcends the tribalism of left and right, and recognize the important role in public life of protest, advocacy, and political parties. And all three are necessary in a balanced and judicious approach to bringing justice imperfectly and peace in this world. And with that, I shall close, and I understand one of my great heroes is John Chrysostom, and I understand your liturgy is going to walk us into Chrysostom, another great peacemaker, one of the finest in the Christian tradition. So thank you.